Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and let's move from one Empire News Corp to another, ExxonMobil. Steve Call is with us, longtime New Yorker writer and founder of the New America Foundation. His book is called Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. Steve, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Thanks, Brian.
And since you've long covered the Middle East and you wrote two books on Afghanistan and the bin Ladens, we're also going to get your take on the Obama visit to Afghanistan in a little while. But first to your ExxonMobil book. Exxon CEO Lee Raymond once said, "I'm not a U.S. company and I don't make decisions based on what's good for the U.S." So how should we see Exxon if not as a U.S. company?
Well, they're sort of an independent sovereign. They're headquartered in the United States. They pay a fair amount of taxes to the United States government, but they also have more employees in other countries than they do here. And they see themselves as a sort of independent sovereign, like other multinationals do that have a certain scale. But in their case, you know, their business model is they drill holes in the ground all over the world and sit on top of them for 40 years at a time. And they have this long-term view of their own interests that's really different from the interests of any state, including the United States. I came over time to sort of think of them as like France. You know, often they're aligned with the United States. Sometimes they're in opposition, but mostly they just try to keep their distance and do their own thing.
There's a lot of, for lack of a better word, empathy in this book. I don't know if you would describe it that way, but you really try to understand Exxon's worldview, even as you reveal all this stuff about them. So as best you can describe it, how does Exxon see the world?
Well, they see it through their business interests and the interests of their shareholders, and they have a very focused view about their business strategy and the primacy of their shareholders guiding their decision-making around the world. But basically what they want is a world of stability and a world that's friendly to the drilling and owning of oil and gas. So they want a world without war. That's generally a good thing. But they also want a world full of property rights and access so that they can own oil and gas, because that's very specifically part of their business model, is to own resources around the world, not just to contract profitably to produce them.
Listeners, your questions for Steve Call on ExxonMobil or on President Obama's new Afghanistan policy announced last night, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. His new book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. You can also post, of course, at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You begin with begin this book with the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska in the late 80s. Exxon was already an incredibly powerful company before the spill. It was a huge public relations disaster. People boycotted Exxon at that point. But you actually say Exxon's most powerful period has actually been since the Valdez spill.
Yeah, and after they merged with Mobil about a decade later, they became the largest oil corporation in the world not owned by a government. And they also acquired a global footprint once they took on Mobil's properties in Africa and in Southeast Asia and other places that really transformed them into the company that they were sort of always imagined themselves to be, a world power able to compete with anybody. And also the Exxon Valdez disaster had another effect on them. It caused them to reform themselves internally and to bring forward a new era of strict rulemaking and operating discipline, a sort of era of idiot-proof global systems so that they could try to wring the potential for human error out of their daily operations as much as possible. And to some extent, they succeeded. They're regarded in the industry as the best operator from a safety perspective and a financial perspective. But the sort of paradox that they've faced all these years since they acquired this global scale is that the way the world works, they're driven more and more into high-risk places. So unstable countries in Africa where they can own oil and gas because the government's too weak to do it itself, and technological frontiers like deep water, the Arctic. So they're constantly managing greater and greater risk from a sort of management culture that's deeply conservative. And that tension is alive every day at the corporation.
And obviously Exxon has learned to navigate the system here in the United States, but as they have to go into more complicated and riskier waters around the world, you show that they are truly expert at working the rules and bending the rules overseas. What's a good example of that?
Well, in a lot of the countries in Africa, for example, where they produce oil, which constitutes – Africa constitutes about 25% of their liquids production on a global basis, they are so overwhelmingly influential in some of these weak countries. Chad, for example, there's a country of 11 million people, a really benighted place, fourth world country, about 181st on the Human Development Index the UN keeps about quality of life out of 187 countries. And the United States government is there. They have an embassy. They provide aid, perhaps $10 million all in, including counterterrorism aid, $10 million a year. Well, ExxonMobil's check writing to the government of Chad, the dictator of Chad, is on the scale of north of $500 million a year. So if you're Idris Deby, the authoritarian leader of Chad, you look over. On the one hand, you see the U.S. embassy. On the other hand, you see the ExxonMobil representative office. Who matters to you? Well, ExxonMobil really is an expression, overwhelmingly, of America's presence in that country.
And one of the things you detail is the way that Exxon worked or didn't work with the World Bank and other government agencies trying to ensure that development happened in Chad in the interest of the people, even as they were, you know, drilling for oil, using the country's resources. What's the relationship there?
Well, Chad was this grand experiment that the World Bank put together, the Clinton administration and ExxonMobil and other groups have developed a plan by which, for the first time in world history, a government would surrender the right to spend its own oil revenue and would route this revenue through banks in London so that it couldn't be stolen, it couldn't be spent on weapons, it had to be spent on education, health, and social development in certain proportions. Deby agreed to this because there was no other way anyone was going to allow him to finance the oil development that Exxon wanted to carry out. So off they go, this great nation-building, almost city-on-a-hill experiment, a lot of hopefulness. 5-6 years in, Deby decides he needs more weapons, and he starts diverting the money. The World Bank calls him on it. Paul Wolfowitz, the former Bush administration deputy defense secretary, who was then running the World Bank, confronted Deby. And ExxonMobil, these documents that I obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests and State Department cables and the like, show that ExxonMobil essentially came along and said, we're making so much money together, you and I, that you can take our tax and royalty money and use it to buy the World Bank out and then rule this country as you like.
Wow.
And that's what Deby did.
Go from Deby to Deborah in Newark. You're on WNYC with Steve Call, author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. Hello, Deborah.
Oh, hello. Thanks very much. What Steve is talking about has been status quo ante since the mid-1920s. There was a study that came out in the early 1930s by the Social Science Committee at the University of Chicago dealing with war and business. I think that was the title of it. I don't have my hand on that book at the moment. And if you explore diplomatic documents, the U.S. State Department in the 1920s, because World War One was the very first war to be fought on the back of petroleum, it was well aware that petroleum would rule the world going forward. And in the 1920s, you had not only American oil companies like Standard Oil and then Humble, which later became Exxon.
And so your point is, Deborah, I'm going to have to move on, but your point is it was ever thus?
No. What I mean is that these companies were striking deals with sovereign nations without any input, without any play on the part of the U.S. government. The only way they would buy an interest was to agree to shape U.S. foreign policy around the business needs of oil multinational corporations and allow them to operate as sovereign entities. And so U.S. foreign policy, since the 1920s, has knowingly and willingly shaped itself around the business needs of the oil companies in order to buy into what the oil companies were doing to exercise some influence on what they were doing.
Thank you very much. And Steve Call, how explicitly do you come to your to the same conclusion in your book about the present day?
Well, it's all there, yeah. I mean, it's there in country after country and case after case. The relationship is complicated, as the caller was, I think, describing. The one thing is about ExxonMobil and Standard Oil, you know, virtually every industrialized country in the oil age has a national oil company of some sort. In many places, they're owned by the government. In Europe, they used to be owned by the government, but they were privatized. Total in France, BP in Britain. Only in the United States does our national oil company, which is in effect what ExxonMobil is, live in a state of sort of defiant opposition against its own government. I mean, the current chief executive, Rex Tillerson, who's a very personable guy, active in the Boy Scouts, but he recently told Scouting magazine that his favorite book is Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. Now, it's sort of odd that the leader of a highly concentrated integrated oil company with that much power would have as his favorite book this sort of dystopia about government and power. And but it's only in America would we have a kind of a national company that is sort of at odds with the state that produced it.
Of course, Paul Ryan, the rising star of the Republican Party, the House Budget Committee chairman, has also talked about his influence by Ayn Rand. And so even in the halls of government, anti-government corporatism seems to be a big influence. But are the implications of what you just said, that the U.S. should do something different than it does today to regulate a company like ExxonMobil, and for that matter, other big multinationals that may be working in some ways against the interest of the United States, even as they are rooted here, as they do their business around the world and consider themselves sovereign?
Well, I think first we just have to understand what our system really is. Exxon, we don't have a national energy policy of any coherence, certainly not a national energy policy that is as strong and coherent as ExxonMobil's private model of profit-making is. So if we really want, for example, to respond to the risks of global warming by migrating quickly away from fossil fuels towards alternatives, then we need to develop the politics to deliver a policy that is coherent and stable and has that goal set for it. Because ExxonMobil is our de facto energy policy, and they've got their elbows out. And it's very difficult to change their sort of influence on the American energy system. And there's another point. You know, if you flip on the switch in the studio here and you generate electric power, there's a corporation that profits from your decision. But in our system, electric power is seen as a fundamental utility, so essential that we regulate it in the public interest through utility commissions. Now, these companies are often private, and there's constant debates about how much privatization is good for the system. But there's a basic assumption that the public has an interest in the delivery of electricity that is compelling enough to warrant a special system of profit regulation and oversight. Now, gasoline really is a similar utility. If you're a construction worker in West Virginia commuting to a housing project outside of Washington, D.C., 100 miles in each direction, you go to the gas pump, you have no choice but to traverse that distance and pay that price. You may not be able to control what happens in the Middle East that causes gas prices to rise and so forth. I think one of the reasons these companies are so unpopular is because ordinary Americans recognize they are captive to gasoline in particular, and they blame the companies for being ruthless in the way that they deliver this essential good. In fact, the companies can't control the price at the pump, but that's a complicated subject.
Steve Call, author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. And I want to switch gears briefly before we run out of time. You've written two fabulous books in the past about the CIA and Afghanistan and the Bin Ladens, one called The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century, and the other, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001. And I want to get your reaction to this, said by President Obama in Afghanistan on his surprise visit yesterday.
Our goal is not to build a country in America's image or to eradicate every vestige of the Taliban. These objectives would require many more years, many more dollars, and most importantly, many more American lives. Our goal is to destroy al-Qaeda, and we are on a path to do exactly that. Afghans want to assert their sovereignty and build a lasting peace. That requires a clear timeline to wind down the war.
So, Steve Call, what do you make of the agreement signed both to provide a timetable for withdrawal, by 2014, but also to stay involved with Afghanistan in particular ways for 10 years after that?
Well, this agreement's been a long time coming, and it was a very difficult agreement to get even in the relatively vague outline form that was signed by the president and by President Karzai. You know, I fear that what's evolved in this war is a kind of double tracking in which you have this narrative of public speech making and agreements in principle and international conferences and various declarations of confidence from heavily guarded palaces in Kabul on the one hand, and then you have the war on the ground on the other, which is really not responding to this public narrative. A speech like yesterday's, obviously in an election year, is as much directed at American domestic audiences as anywhere else, although it was a purpose of the president to try to instill confidence in Afghans that the U.S. was going to stick around long enough to give them a chance to build their own army. But, you know, there's this kind of decoupling, I think, that's been going on between public speech about the war and the facts on the ground. And I'm afraid that some sections of our government seem to be in denial about what's really deteriorating in the war.
Well, you know the history, and I'm going to ask Dan Rather about this, too, later in the show when he comes on. He reported from Afghanistan as early as 1980 when the Soviet invasion was taking place. You know that the U.S. got blamed for abandoning the country after the Soviets left and were defeated, which people say may have contributed to the rise of not only the Taliban but al-Qaeda and therefore 9/11. But at the same time, critics of U.S. power may say, hey, this is classic empire building. We're not just withdrawing. We're digging in our heels over there with a kind of permanent base. Do you think this helps? I don't know. Does it speak to the history in any way?
Yeah, it does. I think you're – I mean, I agree that the decision by the United States to abandon the hard project of unified Afghan national politics after the Soviet war contributed to the rise of created the conditions in which the Taliban rose and in which al-Qaeda found sanctuary, and from that sanctuary they carried out the 9/11 attacks. There's no question about that. And so it's perfectly reasonable for American statesmen to look at that history and say to themselves, well, we're not going to make the same mistake again. But not making the same mistake again is different from not making any mistakes at all. And in order to navigate this very treacherous transition that the president has outlined, one that Afghan history suggests is at best risky because international partners don't have a great history building things in Afghanistan. In order to navigate it, I guess my only point, typical thing a journalist would say, I suppose, is you better keep your eye on the facts. You're never going to succeed at a complicated task if you're in denial about what's really going on. And I think there's more information inside the U.S. intelligence system about how bad the U.S. War is going than is acknowledged, either public speech or in some cases, you know, in the very councils of government. And that's always an unhealthy pattern. It arose in Vietnam, and something like that, I think, is happening here.
30 seconds left. One last question about ExxonMobil real quick. You write that employees at Exxon's headquarters near Dallas actually refer to it as the Death Star. What do they mean by that?
It has a kind of sterile, forbidding quality, this headquarters building. It's like a small college campus. They also refer to it as the God Pod. It's a eerie place, quiet and very authoritative.
Steve Call from the New America Foundation, The New Yorker, former managing editor of The Washington Post. His new book is called Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, redlining and the New York City schools. Then Dan Rather. Stay tuned.